I'm now joined by Adam Butler, Chief Investment Officer at Resolve Asset Management. They're behind the StrategyShares newfound Resolve Robust Momentum ETF, ticker symbol ROMO. This just launched in November, and Adam is on the line with me from just outside Toronto. Adam, a pleasure connecting. Thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks for having me, Nate. Pleasure to be here.
All right, Adam, so Resolve helped develop the index behind ROMO. This was done in partnership with Newfound Research. I guess first, how did that partnership come together?
Well, I mean, Corey and our team have collaborated on a variety of research over the past several years, both formally and informally. We have become close friends, and we share a similar philosophical view about how to engineer systematic trading strategies and just in general about how markets operate, how risk is rewarded, about the objective of investing for most investors. And so those shared visions and shared philosophies, I think, made it really easy to get together and collaborate on an index like this.
And what made you decide to offer this strategy in an ETF wrapper?
Well, there's a few benefits to the ETF. I mean, keep in mind, this strategy it comprises thousands of individual sub-strategies. And so the execution and implementation of this is non-trivial. And so we felt it really needed to be in a product wrapper to be most effective. And then, of course, you have all of the attributes of an ETF, perhaps most notably the tax efficiency, so that we could implement all of the trading within the ETF without triggering annual tax consequences for unit holders who continue to hold the ETF over the long term. Of course, the taxes would be crystallized when the investor disseminated with the units, or sold the units, but not until that point. So you're able to carry that tax growth forward within the ETF structure in a way that you weren't able to do in a traditional mutual fund or trading it in your own account.
Okay, so let's get into the strategy behind this ETF. Again, this is the StrategyShares Newfound Resolve Robust Momentum ETF. You're helping to power the index behind this. Walk us through the investment process. How does this work?
So the objective is to take advantage of the long-term global equity risk premium, but also have the potential to sidestep those catastrophic equity bear markets that have the potential to derail a financial plan or most investors' financial goals. And so the idea behind it is to allocate to global equities when global equities are in a positive trend. And then, we define positive trend in a variety of different ways, which we can get into. But then once we identify that global equities are in a positive trend, then we want to harness the momentum premium to identify the regional equity market that has the strongest momentum. So if you back it up a little bit, trend and momentum are sort of kissing cousins in that they both use historical return data, but whereas trend uses the return data of a single market or a single index to identify whether that market is in a rising trend, or in other words, has positive returns or is above a moving average, for example, over some look back horizon. So it's sort of a positive or negative trend. Momentum is cross-sectional, and so we're identifying which markets have the strongest trend or have the strongest returns or are the furthest above a moving average over a particular horizon. So momentum is used to rank things, whereas trend is used to determine if something is in a positive or negative trend, on or off, or long or short in some contexts. And so the objective here is we want to be long global equities when global equities are in a positive trend. And then if they're in a positive trend, You want to own either U.S. markets, international developed markets, or emerging markets, depending on which one has the strongest momentum.
Okay, Adam, so talk more about how you're actually measuring momentum and looking at trend. How are you doing that behind the scenes?
We measure trend and momentum using a large ensemble of different lookbacks and methods for identifying trends. So, for example, you can identify trend and momentum as just the total return over a certain look-back horizon. Like I said, you could also use the percentage that the price is above some moving average, and you can also use two moving averages, so a short-term moving average and a long-term moving average, and the trend or momentum signal is the distance in percentage that the short-term moving average is above or below the long-term moving average. So three different sort of ways of measuring trend, and then we measure trend using each of those methods over a variety of lookbacks between, call it, around 1 month and about 12 months. In doing that, we capture the rich texture of trend and momentum that exists in markets at every dimension or level of fractal in the market. So weekly, biweekly, monthly, et cetera. And we implement these over different sort of holding periods because we don't really know whether or not it is best to hold a market that is in a positive trend with the strongest momentum for a few days, a few weeks, a month, et cetera. So all of these different decisions are incorporated in this one large ensemble strategy that really is just designed to avoid the potential for being specifically wrong at any point when we're making a decision at a rebalance.
And can you give us a sense, I mean, how many different models are you tracking momentum and trend through?
Well, yeah, there's several thousand.
Okay.
I don't know the exact number, but it's over 30,000 models internally.
And you mentioned the global asset classes here. So the index covers, as I understand it, one to five ETFs, right, that can represent U.S. equities, developed international equities, emerging market equities, and then short and intermediate term U.S. Treasury bonds. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And so you imagine you've got these, it's almost like having 30,000 different experts, and they all view the market from a very slightly different angle. And at each rebalance date, so we rebalance it weekly, and at each rebalance date, all of these different models provide a vote as to which market they prefer to own over the subsequent period. And so the portfolio is just a representation of all of those different votes. So some of them might vote we want to be in U.S. equities, some might vote we want to be in emerging market equities, and some might vote we want to be in intermediate treasuries. And so the portfolio will sort of expand and contract its equity exposure and the individual markets within the equity sleeve and within the fixed income sleeve in proportion to the number of votes that each of these markets get at each rebalance period. So it's not the sort of typical on-off switch that you see in other trend equity products, but we like to describe it as more of a dimmer switch instead of an on-off light switch. So we're very rarely completely out of equities. We're very rarely completely in equities. When we're in equities, we're very rarely exclusively in U.S. or international, but rather it provides a nice sort of diversified balance that emphasizes certain asset classes and certain regional equity markets in proportion to the strength of their signals.
Well, and on that note, I guess, can you give us a sense as to how the strategy is currently allocated?
We're pretty risk-heavy at the moment, so definitely an equity bias in the portfolio, skewed. To be candid, I haven't looked at the portfolio in the last week or so, but I suspect that we are skewed a little bit more heavily toward U.S. equities than international equities, though I have noted that international developed and emerging have have started to strengthen over the last few weeks relative to U.S. equities. So we may indeed see a bit of a rotation there over the coming weeks.
For investors looking at this, how do you think the strategy should be used in a portfolio? And maybe for a good reference point, let's say an investor has a standard 60-40 stock bond portfolio, right? How would the strategy be incorporated into something like that?
Well, over the long term, historically, the strategy has been invested in stocks about 65% of the time and bonds about 35% of the time. So it's for somebody with a 60-40 portfolio, I think it's useful to think about the allocation as coming partly from the bond side of the portfolio, partly from the equity side of the portfolio. And the 60-40 is almost a perfect proportional mix. So you can sort of take an equal amount from bonds and stocks to maintain a long-term representative exposure that is consistent with that strategic policy portfolio. And then what would happen is that call it 10%, you pull 5% from the bond sleeve, 5% from the equity sleeve, then that 10% of the portfolio, when equities are in a persistent trend, then you'll get a swing, an overemphasis on the equity side when equities are in a negative trend or look vulnerable, then you'll get an increasing exposure to fixed income. And so you've got this nice sort of adaptive, responsive sleeve of the portfolio that recognizes that market expected returns are highly conditional and that some of the conditions that help you to find direction in the market are related to the strength and persistence of their trend and which markets are exhibiting the strongest momentum at any given time. So I think that's the best way to sort of carve out a portion for an allocation. And it also helps an investor to sort of benchmark how to think about this sleeve because, you know, there will be periods when this strategy by its nature will get whipsawed. You will not capture the full upside of a market move, of an equity market move, because the strategy had de-risked in the face of a, you know, what looked like it might be a large decline, which never really manifested. And so investors have to sort of realize it's not going to look like an equity portfolio all the time. It will not catch all of the major upswings. But on the other side of that, over a full market cycle, because we expect the strategy to not capture the majority of major bear markets, it'll more than make up for what it loses on some of those whipsaw periods. So it's helpful for an investor to not constantly be benchmarking the strategy just against the equity sleeve, because it's not really designed to be an equity replacement. It's really designed to be sort of a 60-40 replacement.
Adam, I know you're speaking to the index behind Romo, but I always like to ask about cost. And Romo does have a fee of 87 basis points right now, which, you know, in today's cost-obsessive environment is on the higher side. And so given that, I'm sure there are some investors who will say, look, I'll just do this on my own, right? I'll use the 200-day moving average or whatever. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a few things to think about. First of all, like I said, this strategy runs 30,000 or more underlying models, which provides a much smoother transition both between stocks and bonds and in emphasizing U.S. versus international versus emerging markets within the equity sleeve. And as a result of that, you are reducing your vulnerability to timing risk about as much as you can reduce it with a trend-based equity product. And just as an example, some products coming into 2018, which was a difficult year for equity markets, it was also a difficult year for some trend products. But as a great example, there were some products that just got extremely lucky that were focused on the 200-day moving average, for example, as their signal to either exit equity markets or be long equity markets, and they rebalance monthly, And coming into the end of November, the signal for U.S. equity markets based on a 200-day moving average would have had the investor be completely out of equities.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd been using a 210-day or 190-day moving average instead of a 200-day, they would have still been long equities for the full decline in December. And, you know, the difference between being long or short was between 0.5% and 1% in terms of where the index was at the end of November. And so you can imagine, you know, 1% above or below is just complete random noise, right? And so, you know, the interesting thing about these on-off models, say that a 200-day moving average model, is it expresses the view that you can be 100% certain when you're making decisions about whether you want to be long stocks or out of stocks, which seems kind of absurd when you think about it. I mean, how often are we ever 100% confident about any decision in equity markets? And so that's kind of what this product reflects, is a sort of humble view, a modest view of the amount of confidence that we can have in any determination of direction or emphasis in markets. And so that's why it takes positions in proportion to the essentially the level of confidence that we have in any different direction. So there's that. I'd also like to point out that the actual management fee of the ETF is 49 basis points. The current MER is around 87 basis points, just layering on the excess costs, and we're capping it there. But as we add more assets over time, we obviously expect the costs to converge on the actual management fee toward sort of 49 basis points. So from that perspective, it's actually reasonably inexpensive, I think. And lastly, when you factor in the potential tax savings from the ETF structure, you can imagine somebody running this in their account on their own and harvesting a gain each and every year. Well, you've got to pay tax on that gain every year, whereas that tax is potentially deferred within the ETF structure. So I think I'd be hard-pressed to be convinced the combination of the more robust strategy design plus the tax efficiency of the ETF structure wouldn't overcome almost any arguments for running this on an individual running on their own in their own accounts.
That's extremely well said, and I love the analogy you used earlier of a dimmer switch, right? This isn't an on-off light switch. This is a much more nuanced approach, and that's, I think, something investors need to consider. Adam, before I let you go, and I guess sort of on the note of investment costs, as you know, the past decade was marked by the rise of low-cost, passive, market cap-weighted investing. And the fact is, that did prove to be a great place for investors. The question I have for you is, what about moving forward? Do you think too many investors are hanging their hat on cheap beta now?
Well, first of all, I think it's worthwhile to note that if you are invested in ultra-low-cost, commoditized, non-U.S. markets over the past decade, that your perception about the efficacy of low-cost, market-cap-weighted index funds may be vastly different than if you've been invested in U.S. market-cap-weighted funds. I would also note that there is no evidence in the historical data that supports the view that market cap weighted indexing is even remotely optimal. In fact, I often point to a study out of Cass Business School from 2 or 3 years ago where the researcher ran an analysis of randomly selected portfolios rebalanced annually from the point in time 1,000 largest market cap stocks in the U.S. From 1964 to 2014. And so this randomly chose portfolios of these 1,000 stocks and rebalanced them annually and then observed the performance of each of these different random strategies and ran, I think it was 10,000 of these different simulations and then plotted the performance of each of these different random portfolios against the market portfolio and almost all of these random portfolios beat the market portfolio over the over that investment horizon. I think it was well over 99% beat the market portfolio. So what's interesting is that the market cap weighted portfolio, I would argue, is almost perfectly inefficient. You've got this allocation to ultra large cap stocks. Nevin Faber publishes great research. He's got a great research note out about a year ago that shows that a strategy that invests in only the top five largest cap stocks each year dramatically underperforms the broader S&P 500, for example, that the biggest, baddest stocks in the index typically go on to dramatically underperform over the next 5 or 10 years. And yet the market cap weighted index, by definition, has its largest exposure to those very stocks. And we know that there are other strategies that actually provide exposure, broad market exposure, are more diversified in terms of their ability to emphasize or harvest risk from all of the different dimensions of the economy, and that have a long history of pretty dramatically outperforming the S&P 500, such as, for example, the minimum variance portfolio. There's several, like Vanguard has a minimum variance U.S. equity portfolio, ETF. I know that iShares does, based on the MSCI minimum variance. So there are much, much better options, in my view. There's a global minimum variance portfolio for investors who want to keep an eye on costs, but recognize that it's not all about costs, but there's an opportunity to do perhaps even considerably better in your portfolio by just moving a little bit further out the cost curve.
Adam, if that's the case, what changes the narrative on market cap weighting? Do you think it's just more investor education? Because right now, I think, you know, as a whole, market cap weighting is sort of viewed as the end-all be-all. So what changes that narrative?
I think what we'll see is a reversion to the mean. I mean, we've had I just created an analysis. I posted it to Twitter about a week ago, where I simulated. I took all the monthly returns for the S&P 500 from 1900 to 2019. So all those monthly returns, and I just mixed them all up so that I created a thousand different simulated or possible simulated return streams for the S&P 500 from 1900 to 2019, but I just took 10-year chunks of those. So go out and randomly grab 120 months from 1900 to 2019, string them together, what was the performance? Go out and grab another 120 months, string them together, what was the performance? Did that 1,000 times. And what I discovered was that the last decade was a 94th percentile outcome for U.S. stocks. So in other words, we would only expect that type of performance less than 6% of the time, given the distribution of the historical track record of U.S. markets. And so last decade was far from a representative sample. Investors should not get used to those types of returns. And the other thing to think about is that the U.S. market over the in-sample period from 1900 to 2018 has delivered a risk premium about 2% higher than the risk premium of equity markets outside the U.S. So I think investors need to ask the question, why should U.S. equity markets continue to deliver such a strong 2% premium over the equity markets in the rest of the world in an efficient environment? If you're invested in market cap portfolios, you're expressing a view that markets are efficient. In an efficient environment, why should one market consistently be granted a premium, not just in terms of excess return, but in terms of excess risk-adjusted return? Something doesn't jive. So I would expect some kind of reversion to the mean where international markets catch up to U.S. markets. I think that would rattle certain investors who are ultra confident in their passive approach. And, I think just any sort of process where U.S. equity passive investors are disappointed with the returns of their portfolio over a protracted period will shake confidence and cause them to consider alternatives.
Well, Adam, on that note, we'll have to leave it there. Congratulations on the ETF. Certainly wish you all the best. And you'll be down at Inside ETFs, correct?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing you there and probably many of the other guests on your podcast and hopefully some of the listeners.
Yeah, let's definitely connect down there. But thank you very much for joining me this week. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nate. Had a good time. Have a great day.
That was Adam Butler, Chief Investment Officer at Resolve Asset Management.